balls of light, the Zaw Lord's guard, darted back and forth, a wary ring of sentinels spread in a perimeter that moved as I did. Several blocks away, I found an all-night grocery store and staggered in out of the cold. The clerk glared at me until I hobbled over, clumsily dug change out of my pockets, and left it next to the cash register before shuffling to the coffee counter. At that point, the clerk evidently decided that he wouldn't have to get out the shotgun or whatever he had behind the counter and went back to staring out the window. There were a few other shoppers there, and I saw a police car crunch through the snow on the street outside, probably responding to the alarm at the building. Nice and public, probably safe. I was so cold, I could barely fill up the cup. The coffee burned my tongue a little, which was absolutely delicious, even served black. I guzzled the hot drink and felt sensation begin returning to my body. I stood there for a moment with my eyes closed and finished the coffee. Then I crushed the paper cup and tossed it into the trash. Someone had snatched John Marcone, and I had to find him and protect him. I had a feeling that Murphy wasn't going to be thrilled with the circumstances around this one. Hell's bells, I wasn't happy with it. But that really wasn't what was bothering me. What really worried me was that Mab had been involved. What was the deal with having Grimalkin along to do her talking for her? Aside from making her seem even more extremely disturbing than usual, I mean. Oh, sure. Mab may have seemed fairly straightforward, but there was a lot more going on than she was saying. For example, Mab had said that Summer's hitmen were after me because Mab had chosen me to be her emissary. But for that to be true, she had to have done it hours ago, at least a little while before the first crew of gruffs had attacked me at the Carpenter place. And that had happened several hours before the bad guys grabbed Marcone. Someone was running a game, all right. Someone was keeping secrets. I had a bad feeling that if I didn't find out who, why, and how, Mab would toss me into the trash like a used paper cup. Right after she crushed me, of course. Chapter 8. A wide-axled, full-of-itself military wannabe truck crunched through the snowy streets and came to a halt outside the little grocery store. The lights glared in through the doors. I squinted at it. After a minute, the Hummer's horn blared in two short beeps. "Oh, you gotta be kidding me," I muttered. I hobbled to the door and out to the truck, which blended seamlessly with the background and the foreground and with most of the air. The driver's side window rolled down and revealed a young man whom fathers of teenage daughters would shoot on sight. He had pale skin and deep gray eyes. His dark, slightly curly hair was long enough to declare casual rebellion and tousled to careless perfection. He wore a black leather jacket and a white shirt, both of them more expensive than any two pieces of furniture in my apartment. In marked contrast, there was a scarf, inexpertly crocheted from thick white yarn around his neck, under the collar of the jacket. He faced straight ahead so that I saw only his profile, but I felt confident that he was smirking on the other side of his face, too. "Thomas," I said, "a lesser man than me would hate you." He grinned. "There's someone lesser than you." He rolled his eyes to me on the last word, to deadpan the delivery, and his face froze in an expression of absolute neutrality. He stayed that way for a few seconds. "Empty night, Harry. You look like 10 miles of bad road." He forced a smile onto his mouth, but that was as far as it went. "I was going to go with Raccoon." "Gee, thanks. Get in." He took the monorail to the other side of the Hummer's cab to unlock the passenger side door. I showed up eventually and noticed every little ache in my body on the way, especially the throbbing burn centered on my broken nose. I tossed my staff onto the back of Das Truck, half expecting an echoing clatter when it landed. I got in, shut the door, and put on my seatbelt while Thomas got the truck moving. He peered carefully into the heavy snow, presumably looking for some runty little sedans he could drive over for fun. "Well, that's gotta hurt," he said after a moment. "Only when I exhale," I said testily. "What took you so long?" "Well, you know how much I love getting called in the middle of the night to drive through snow and ice to play chauffeur for grumpy low-life investigators. The anticipation slowed me down." I grunted in what might have been construed as an apologetic manner by someone who knew me. Thomas did. What's up? I told him everything. Thomas is my half-brother, my only family. I'm allowed. He listened. And then, I concluded, I went for a ride in a monster truck. Thomas's mouth twitched up in a quick smile. It is kind of butch, isn't it? I squinted around the truck. Do TV shows start an hour later in the back seat than they do up here? Who cares, Thomas said. It's got TiVo. Good, I said. It might be a little while before I return you to your regularly scheduled programming. Thomas let out a theatrical sigh. Why me? Because if I want to find Marcone, the best place to start is with his people. If word gets out that he's gone missing, there's no telling how some of them might react when I come snooping around. So you've got my back. What if I don't want your back? Cope, I said heartlessly. Your family. You've got me there, he admitted. But I wonder if you've thought this through very thoroughly. I try to make thinking an ongoing process. Thomas shook his head. Look, you know I don't try to tell you your business. Except tonight, apparently, I said. Marcone is a grown-up, Thomas said. He signed on to the accords willingly. He knew what he was going to be letting himself in for. And? I said. And it's a jungle out there, Thomas said. He squinted through the thick snow, metaphorically speaking. I grunted. He made his bed and I should let him lie in it? Something like that, Thomas said. And don't forget that Murphy and the police aren't going to be thrilled with a Save the Kingpin campaign. I know, I said, and I'd love to stand back and see what happens. But this isn't about Marcone anymore. Then what is it about? Mab's skinning me alive if I don't give her what she wants? Come on, Harry, Thomas said. You really can't think that Mab's motives and plans are that direct, that cut and dried. He adjusted the setting of the Hummer's wipers. She wants Marcone for a reason. You might not be doing him any favors by saving him on Mab's behalf. I scowled out at the night. He held up a hand, ticking off fingers. And that's assuming that one, he's alive at all right now, two, that you can find him, three, that you can get him out alive, and four, that the opposition doesn't cripple or kill you. What's your point? I asked. That you're playing against a stacked deck, and that you have no idea if Mab is going to be there to cover your bets when the bad guys call. He shook his head. It would be smarter for you to skip town. Go someplace warm for a few weeks. Mab might take that kind of personal, I said. Mab's a businesswoman, Thomas said. Creepy and weird, but she's cold, too. Calculating. As long as you still represent a potential recruit to her, I doubt she'd elect to depreciate your value prematurely. Depreciate? I like that. You might be right. Unless, to return to the original metaphor, Mab isn't playing with a full deck, which the evidence of recent years seems to imply with increasing frequency. I nodded out the window. And I've got a feeling that I'd have had even more trouble with the gruffs I've seen so far if we weren't in the middle of a freaking blizzard. If I waltz off to Miami or somewhere warm, I'll be putting myself that much nearer to the agents of summer, who are also planning my murder. Thomas frowned and said nothing. I could run, but I couldn't hide, I said. Better to face it here, on my home ground, while I'm still relatively rested. I let out a huge and genuine yawn. Instead of waiting for fairy goons from one court or the other to, depreciate me by surprise after I'd been on the run for a few weeks. What about the council? Thomas demanded. You've been wearing the gray cloak for how long now? And you fought for them how many times? I shook my head. Right now the council is still stretched to the limit. We might not be in open battle with the Red Court at the moment, but the council and the wardens have got years of catch-up work to do. I felt my jaw tighten. Lots of warlocks have come up in the past few years. The wardens are working overtime to get them under control. You mean kill them, Thomas said. I mean kill them. Most of them teenagers, man. I shook my head. Lucio knows my feelings on the matter. She refuses to assign any of it to me. Which means that the other wardens are forced to pick up the slack. I'm not going to add to their workload by dragging them into this mess. You don't seem to mind adding to mine, Thomas noted. I snorted. That's because I respect them. So long as we have that clear, he said. We drove past a city snowplow. It had foundered in a deep drift, like some kind of metallic ice age beast trapped in a tar pit. I watched it with bemusement as Thomas's truck crunched slowly, steadily on by. "By the way," he asked, "where do you want to go?" "First things first," I said. "I need food." "You need sleep." "Tick-tock. Food will do for now." I pointed. "There. An IHOP." He hauled the big truck into a slow, steady turn. "Then what?" "I ask people impertinent questions," I said, hopefully turning up pertinent answers. "Assuming someone doesn't kill you while you do. That's why I'm bringing my very own vampire bodyguard." Thomas parked across three spaces in the tiny, otherwise unoccupied lot of an international house of pancakes. "I like the scarf," I said. I leaned over and inhaled through my nose as best I could. It stung, but I detected a faint whiff of vanilla and strawberries. "She make it for you?" Thomas nodded without saying anything. The leather-gloved fingers of one hand traced over the soft, simple yarn. He looked quietly sad. I felt bad for mentioning Justine, my brother's lost lover. Then I understood why he wore the gloves. If she'd made it for him, a token of her love, he didn't dare touch it with his skin. It would sear him like a hot skillet. So he kept it close enough for him to smell her touch upon it, but he didn't dare let it brush against him. Every time I think my romantic life is a wasteland, I look at my brother and see how much worse it could be. Thomas shook his head and killed the engine, and we sat for a moment in silence. So I clearly heard a deep male voice outside the truck say, "Don't either of you move." There was a distinct click-clack of a shotgun's pump working, "or I will kill you." Chapter 9. When there's a gun pointed at you, you've got two options. Either you move fast and unexpectedly and hope that you get lucky, or you freeze and try to talk your way clear. Given that I had really limited room in which to attempt to dodge or run, I went with option B. I held still. "I don't suppose," I asked hopefully, "that this is the full military model?"
"It has individually heated seats and a 6-disc CD changer," Thomas said. I scowled. "Uh-huh. Those are way cooler than silly features like armor and bulletproof glass."
"Hey," Thomas said. "It's not my fault that you have special needs."
"Harry," said the man with the shotgun, "hold up your right hand, please."
I arched an eyebrow at that. Typically, the vocabulary of thugs holding guns to your head ran a little light on courtesy phrases like please.
"You want me to kill him?"
Thomas murmured, barely audible. I twitched my head in a tiny negative motion. Then I lifted up my right hand, fingers spread.
"Turn it around," said the man outside. "Let me see the inside of your wrist."
I did.
"Oh, thank God," breathed the voice.
I'd finally placed it. I turned my head to one side and said through the glass,
"Hey there, Fix. Is that a shotgun you're holding to my head, or are you just glad to see me?"
Fix was a young, slender man of medium height. His hair was silver-white and very fine, and though no one would ever accuse him of beauty, there was a confidence and surety in his plain features that gave them a certain appeal. He was a far cry from the nervous, scrawny kid I'd met several years ago. He wore jeans and a green silk shirt, nothing more. He obviously should have been freezing, and he just as obviously wasn't. The thickly falling snowflakes weren't striking him. Every single one seemed to find its way to the ground around him, somehow. He held a pump-action shotgun with a long barrel against his shoulder and wore a sword on a belt at his hip.
"Harry," he said, his voice steady.
His tone wasn't hostile.
"Can we have a polite talk?"
"We probably could have," I said, "if you hadn't started off by pointing a gun at my head."
"A necessary precaution," he said. "I needed to be sure you hadn't taken Mab's offer."
"And become the new Winter Knight?" I asked. "You could have asked me, Fix."
"If you'd become Mab's creature," Fix said, "you would have lied. It would have changed you, made you an extension of her will. I couldn't trust you."
"You're the Summer Knight," I replied, "so I can't help but wonder if that wouldn't make you just as controlled and untrustworthy. Summer's not at all happy with me right now, apparently. Maybe you're just an extension of Summer's will."
Fix stared at me down the barrel of the shotgun.
and then he lowered it abruptly and said,
"Touché."
Thomas produced from nowhere a semi-automatic pistol scaled to fit his truck, and had it trained on Fix's head before the other man had finished speaking the second syllable of the word. Fix's eyes widened.
"Holy crap."
I sighed and took the gun gently from Thomas's grip. Now, let's not give him the wrong idea about the nature of this conversation. Fix let out a slow breath.
"Thank you, Harry, I
pointed the gun at Fix's head, and he froze with his mouth partly open. "Lose the shotgun," I told him. I made no effort to sound friendly. His mouth closed, and his lips pressed into a thin line, but he obeyed. "Step back," I said. He did it. I got out of the car, carefully keeping the gun trained on his head. I recovered the shotgun and passed it back to Thomas. Then I faced the silver-haired summer night in dead silence while the snow fell. "Fix," I said quietly, after a moment had passed. "I know you've been spending a lot of time in the supernatural circles lately. I know that plain old things like guns don't seem like a significant threat in some ways. I know that you probably meant it as a message, that you weren't coming after me with everything you could bring to bear, and that I was supposed to consider it a token of moderation." I squinted down the sight of Thomas's gun. "But you crossed a line. You pointed a gun at my head. Friends don't do that." More silence and snowfall. "Point another weapon at me," I said quietly, "and you damn well better pull the trigger. Do you understand me?" Fix's eyes narrowed. He nodded once. I let him look down the gun's barrel for a few more seconds, and then lowered it. "It's cold," I said. "What do you want?"
"I came here to warn you, Harry," Fix said. "I know Mab has chosen you to act as her emissary. You don't know what you're getting into. I came to tell you to stand clear of it."
"Or what?"
"Or you're going to get hurt," Fix said quietly. He sounded tired. "Maybe killed, and there's going to be collateral damage along the way."
He held up a hand and continued hurriedly.
"Please understand. I'm not threatening you, Harry. I'm just telling you about consequences."
"I'd have an easier time believing that if you hadn't opened the conversation by threatening to kill me," I said.
"The last summer night was murdered by his winter counterpart," Fix replied. "In fact, that's how most of them die. If you'd taken service with Mab, I wouldn't stand a chance in a fair fight against you, and we both know it. I did what I had to do in order to warn you and still protect myself."
"Oh," I said. "It was a precautionary shotgun aimed at my skull. That makes it different."
"Damn it, Dresden," Fix said. "What do I have to do to get you to listen to me?"
"Behave in a vaguely trustworthy fashion," I said. "For instance, next time you know that Summer's hitters are about to make a run at me, maybe you could call me on a telephone and give me a little heads up." Fix grimaced, his face twisted into an expression of effort. When he spoke, his jaws stayed locked together, but I could with difficulty understand the words.
"Wanted to."
"Oh," I said. A big chunk of my anger evaporated. It was probably just as well. Fix wasn't the one who deserved to be on the receiving end of it. "I can't back off." He drew in a breath and nodded as if in comprehension.
"Mab's got a handle on you."
"For now." He gave me a rather bleak smile.
"She isn't the sort to let go of anyone she wants to keep."
"And I'm not the sort who gets kept," I replied.
"Maybe not," Fix said, but he sounded dubious. "Are you sure you won't reconsider?"
"We're gonna have to agree to disagree."
"Jesus," Fix said, looking away. "I don't want to square off against you, Dresden."
"Then don't." He stared quietly at me, his expression serious.
"I can't back off either. I like you, Harry, but I can't make you any promises."
"We're playing for opposite teams," I said. "Nothing personal, but we'll do what we have to do." Fix nodded. We didn't speak for almost a minute. Then I laid the shotgun down in the snow, nodded, and got back into Thomas's truck. I gave the huge automatic back to my brother. Fix made no move toward the shotgun.
"Harry!"
he said as the truck started to pull out. His mouth twitched a few times before he blurted,
"Remember the leaf Lily gave you?"
I frowned at him, but nodded. Thomas got the truck moving again and started driving. Windshield wipers squeaked. Snow crunched beneath tires. A steady white noise.
"Okay," Thomas said. "What
was that all about? Guy's supposed to be a friend, and he screwed you over. I thought you were going to pistol whip him for a minute. Then you start getting all teary-eyed.
Metaphorically speaking, I said, tiredly.
You know what I mean.
He's under a gias, Thomas.
Thomas frowned.
Lily's got him in a brain lock?
I doubt she'd do that to Fix. They go back.
Who then?
My money's on Titania, the Summer Queen. If she told him to keep his mouth shut and not help me, he wouldn't get a choice in the matter. Probably why he showed up armed and tried to intimidate me. He wouldn't be able to speak to me outright, but if he's delivering a threat in order to further Titania's plans, it might let him get around the Gias.
Seems pretty thin to me. You believe him?
Titania's done it to him before, and she doesn't really like me.
You kill someone's daughter, that happens, he said.
I shrugged wearily, tired to my bones. The combination of pain, cold, and multiple bursts of adrenaline had worn me down a lot more than I had realized. I couldn't stop another yawn.
What was he talking about as we pulled out?
Oh,
I mumbled.
After that mess at Arctis Tor, Lily gave me a silver pin in the shape of an oak leaf. It makes me an Esquire of Summer. Supposedly I can use it to whistle up help from Titania's court. It's their way of balancing the scales for what we did.
Never a bad thing to be owed a favor, Thomas agreed.
You got it on you?
Yeah, I said.
It was, in fact, in a little ring box within the inner coat of my duster. I got it out and showed it to Thomas. He whistled.
Gorgeous work.
Is she no pretty, I agreed.
Maybe you can use it and get them to back off.
I snorted. It's never that simple. Titania could decide that the best way to help me would be to break my back, paralyze me from the waist down, and dump me into a hospital bed so that Agruffs won't have to kill me.
Thomas grunted.
Then why would Fix mention it?
Maybe he was compelled to, I said.
Maybe Titania's hoping I'll call for help and she'll have a chance to squash me personally. Or maybe... I let my voice trail off for a moment while I kicked my punch-drunk brain in the stomach until it threw up an idea.
Or maybe, I said, because he wanted to warn me about it. The Gruffs have found me twice now, and they haven't been physically tailing or tracking me. Neither location was one of my regular hangouts. And how did Fix find me just now, in the middle of a blizzard? He sure as hell didn't coincidentally pick a random IHOP.
Thomas's eyes widened in realization.
It's a tracking device.
I scowled at the beautiful little silver leaf and said, not without a certain amount of grudging admiration,
Titania, that conniving bitch.
Damn, Thomas said. I feel a little bad for pointing a gun at the shrimp now.
I probably would too, I said, if I wasn't so weirded out by the fact that Fix is starting to be as crab-wise and squirrely as the rest of the she.
Thomas grunted.
Better get rid of that thing before more of them show up.
He hit the control that lowered the passenger window. It coughed and rattled a little before it jerked into motion instead of smoothly gliding down.
Wizards and technology don't get along so well.
To high-tech equipment, I am the living avatar of Murphy's Law. The longer I stayed in Thomas's shiny new oil tanker, the more all the things that could go wrong would go wrong. I lifted the leaf to chuck it out, but something made me hesitate.
No, I murmured.
Thomas blinked. No?
No,
I said with more certainty, closing my hand around the treacherous silver leaf.
I've got a better idea.
Chapter 10. I finished the spell that I thought would keep the Gruffs busy and climbed wearily out of my lab to find Thomas sitting by the fireplace. My big gray dog, Mouse, lay beside him, his fur reflecting highlights of reddened silver in the firelight, watching Thomas's work with interest. My brother sat cross-legged on the floor, with my gun lying disassembled on a soft leather cloth upon the hearth. He frowned in concentration as he cleaned the pieces of the weapon with a brush, a soft cloth, and a small bottle of oil. Mister, my hypothyroid tomcat, bounded over the minute I opened the trap door to the lab and hurried down the folding staircase into the sub-basement.
Go get 'em, Tiger, I muttered after him by way of encouragement. Make 'em run their little hoofs off.
I left the door open, heaved myself to the couch, and collapsed. Mouse's tail thumped the floor gently.
You all right?
Thomas asked.
Tired, I said. Big spell.
Mm-hmm, he said, working industriously on the weapons barrel. What building did you burn down? Your apartment, if you don't lay off the wise-ass commentary, I said. Give me a minute, and we'll get moving. Thomas gave me a sidelong, calculating look. I needed another minute or two anyway. When's the last time you cleaned this thing? Who's the president now? Thomas clucked his teeth in disapproval and returned to the gun. Let me know when you're ready.
Just give me a minute to catch my breath, I said.
When I woke up, there was dim light coming from my mostly buried basement windows, and my neck felt like the bones had been welded together by a badly trained contractor. The various beatings I'd received the night before had formed a corporation and were attempting a hostile takeover of my nervous system. I groaned and looked around. Thomas was sitting with his back against the wall beside the fireplace, as relaxed and patient as any tiger. His gun, mine, and the bent-bladed kukri knife he'd favored lately lay close at hand. Down in my lab, something clattered to the floor from one of the shelves or tables. I heard Mister's paws scampering over the metal surface of the center table. What are you grinning at? My brother asked. Mister, I said. He's been knocking around down there all morning, Thomas said. I was going to go round him up before he broke something, but the skull told me to leave him alone. Yeah, I said. I creaked to my feet and shuffled to my little alcove with delusions of kitchenhood. I got out the bottle of aspirin and downed them with a glass of water. For your own safety. Mister gets upset when someone gets between him and his packet of catnip. I shuffled over to the lab and peered down. Sure enough, the little cloth bag containing catnip and a silver oak leaf pen still hung from the extra-large rubber band I'd snipped and fixed to the ceiling directly over Little Chicago. As I watched, Mister hopped up onto a work table, then bounded into the air to bat at the cloth bag. He dragged it down to the table with him, claws hooked in the fabric, and landed on the model of Lincoln Park. My cat rubbed his face ecstatically against the bag for a moment, then released it and batted playfully at it, as the rubber band sent it rebounding back and forth near him. Then he seemed to realize he was being watched. He turned his face up to me, meowed smugly, flicked the stub of his tail jauntily, and hopped to the floor. Bob, I called. Is the spell still working?
Aye, Captain,
Bob said.
Arr!
What's with that? Thomas murmured from right beside me. I twitched hard enough to take me up off the floor and glared at him.
Would you stop doing that?
He nodded, his expression serious, but I could see the corners of his mouth quivering with the effort not to smile. Right. Forgot. I growled and called him something unkind yet accurate. He wouldn't stop begging me to take him to see that pirate movie, so I took him with me the last time I went to the drive-in down in Aurora, and he got into it. It's been dying down, but if he calls me matey one more time, I'll snap. Well, that's interesting, Thomas said, but that's not what I was asking about. Oh, right, I said. I pointed at the catnip bag. The leaf's in there. Isn't that going to draw Summer's goons here? I let out a nasty laugh.
No. They can't see it through the wards around the lab.
Then why the big rubber band?
I linked Summer's beacon spell to the matrix around Little Chicago.
Every time the leaf gets within a foot of the model, my spell transfers the beacon signal to the corresponding location in the city. Thomas narrowed his eyes in thought, and then suddenly grinned in understanding as Mister pounced on the catnip again, this time landing near the Field Museum. If they're following that beacon, they'll be running all over town. In 2.5 feet of snow, I confirmed, grinning.
You're sadistic.
Thank you, I said solemnly.
Won't they figure it out?
Sooner or later, I admitted. But it should buy us a little time to work with. Excuse me. I shambled to the door and put on my coat.
Where to first? Thomas asked. Nowhere just yet. Sit tight.
I grabbed my square-headed snow shovel from the popcorn tin by the door, where it usually resided with my staff, sword cane, and the epically static magic sword Fidelocius. Mouse followed me out. It was a job of work to get the door open, and more than a little snow spilled over the threshold. I started with shoveling the stairs and worked my way up, a grave digger in reverse. Once that was done, I shoveled the little sidewalk, the front porch of the boarding house, and the exterior stairs running up to the Willoughby's apartment on the second floor. Then I dug a path to the nest of mailboxes by the curb. It took me less time than I thought it would. There was a lot of snow, but it hadn't formed any layers of ice, and it was basically a question of tossing powder out of the way. Mouse kept watch, and I tried not to throw snow into his face. We returned to my apartment, and I slung the shovel's handle back down into the popcorn tin. Thomas frowned at me.
You had to shovel the walk.
Harry, somehow I'm under the impression that you aren't feeling the urgency here.
In the first place, I said, I'm not terribly well motivated to bend over backward to save John Marcone's Armani-clad ass. I wouldn't lose much sleep over him. In the second place, my neighbors are elderly, and if someone doesn't clean up the walks, they'll be stuck here. In the third place, I've got to do whatever I can to make sure I'm on my landlady's good side. Mrs. Spunklecreef is almost deaf, but it's sort of hard to hide it when assassin demons or gangs of zombies kick down the door. She's willing to forgive me the occasional wild party because I do things like shovel the walk.
It's easier to replace an apartment than your ass, Thomas said. I shrugged.
I was so stiff and sore from yesterday that I had to do something to get my muscles loosened up and moving. The time was going to be gone either way. Might as well take care of my neighbors.
I grimaced.
Besides, you feel bad because your landlady's building sometimes gets busted up because you live in it, Thomas said.
He shook his head and snorted.
Typical.
Well, yeah, but that's not it.
He frowned at me, listening.
I struggled to find the right words. There are a lot of things I can't control. I don't know what's going to happen in the next few days. I don't know what I'm going to face, what kind of choices I'm going to have to make. I can't predict it. I can't control it. It's too big. I nodded at my shovel. But that I can predict. I know that if I pick up that shovel and clear the snow from the walkways, it's going to make my neighbors safer and happier. I glanced at him and shrugged. It's worthwhile. To me. Give me a minute to shower.
He regarded me for a second and then nodded.
Oh, he said, with the tiniest of smiles. He mimed a sniff and a faint grimace.
I'll wait, gladly.
I cleaned up. We were on the way out the door when the phone rang.
Harry, Murphy said. What the hell is going on out there?
Why? I asked. What the hell is going on out there?
We've had at least 24, well, I suppose the correct term is sightings. Everything from Bigfoot to mysterious balls of light. Naturally, it's all getting shunted to SI.
I started to answer her, then paused. Marcone and the outfit were involved. While they didn't have anywhere near the influence in civic affairs that they might have wanted, Marcone had always had sources of information inside the police department. Sources his subordinates could, presumably, access as well. It would be best to exercise some caution.
You calling from the station? I asked her.
Yeah.
We should talk, I said.
Murphy might not want to admit that anyone she worked with could be providing information to the outfit, but she wasn't the sort to stop believing the truth just because she didn't like it.
I see, she said. Where?
McAnally's, I said. I checked a clock.
3 hours?
See you there. I hung up and started for the door again. Mouse followed close at my heels, but I turned and nudged him gently back with my leg.
Not this time, boy, I told him. The bad guys have a lot of manpower, access to skilled magic, and I need a safe place to come home to. If you're here, there's no way anyone's going to sneak in and leave me a present that goes boom.
Mouse huffed out a breath and a sigh, but sat down.
Keep an eye on Mister, all right? If he starts getting sick, take the catnip away.
My dog gave the door to the lab a dubious glance.
Oh, give me a break, I said. You're 7 times as big as he is.
Mouse looked none too confident.
Thomas blinked at me and then at the dog. Can he understand you?
When it suits him, I grumped. He's smarter than a lot of people I know.
Thomas took a moment to absorb that, and then faced Mouse a little uncertainly.
Okay, look, what I said about Harry earlier, I wasn't serious, okay? It was totally a joke.
Mouse flicked his ears and turned his nose away from Thomas with great nobility.
What? I asked, looking between them. What did you say?
I'll warm up the car, Thomas said, and retreated to the frozen gray outdoors.
This is my home, I complained to no one in particular. Why do people keep making jokes at my expense in my own freaking home?
Mouse declined to comment.
I locked up behind me, magically and materially, and scaled Mount Hummer to sit in the passenger seat. The morning was cold and getting colder, especially since I was fresh from the shower, but the seat was rather pleasantly warm. There was no way I'd admit to Thomas that the luxury feature was superior to armored glass, but gosh, it was cozy.
Right, Thomas said. Where are we headed?
To where they treat me like royalty, I said.
We're going to Burger King.
I rubbed the heel of my hand against my forehead and spelled fratricide in a subvocal mutter, but I had to spell out temporary insanity and justifiable homicide, too, before I calmed down enough to speak politely.
Just take a left and drive, please.
Well, Thomas said, grinning, since you said please.
Chapter 11. Executive Priority Health was arguably the most exclusive gym in town. Located in downtown Chicago, the business took up the entire second floor of what used to be one of the grand old hotel buildings. Now it had office buildings on the upper levels and a miniature shopping center on the first floor. Not just anyone could take the private elevator to the second floor. One had to be a member of the health club, and membership was tightly controlled and extremely expensive. Only the wealthiest and most influential men had a membership card. Oh, and me. The magnetic stripe on the back of the card didn't work when I swiped it through the card reader. No surprise there. I'd had it in my wallet for several months, and I doubt the magnetic signature stored on the card had lasted more than a couple of days. I hit the intercom button on the console.
Executive Priority, said a cheerful young woman's voice. This is Billy, and how may I serve you?
Thomas glanced at me and arched an eyebrow, mouthing the words,
Serve you? You'll see, I muttered to him.
I addressed the intercom. My card seems to have stopped working. Harry Dresden and guest, please.
One moment, sir, Billy said.
She was back within a few seconds.
I apologize for the problem with your membership card, sir. I'm opening the elevator for you now.
True to her word, the elevator opened and Thomas and I got in. It opened onto the main area of executive priority.
You're kidding me, Thomas said. Since when do you go to the gym?
It looked pretty typically gym-like from here. Lots and lots of exercise machines and weight benches and dumbbells and mirrors. Static bikes and treadmills stood in neatly dressed ranks. They'd paid some madman who thought he was a decorator a lot of money to make the place look hip and unique. Maybe it's my lack of fashion sense talking, but I thought they should have held out for one of those gorillas who has learned to paint. The results would have been of similar quality, and they could have paid in fresh produce. Here and there, men, mostly white, mostly over 40, suffered through a variety of physical activities. Beside each and every one of them was a personal trainer coaching, supporting, helping. The trainers were all women, none of them older than their late 20s. They all wore ridiculously brief jogging shorts so tight that it had to be some kind of minor miracle that allowed the blood to keep flowing through the girls' legs. They all wore t-shirts with the gym's logo printed on them, also tight, and every single woman there had the kind of body that made her outfit look fantastic. No gym in the world had that many gorgeous girls in its employ.
Ah, Thomas said after a moment of looking around, this isn't a typical health club, is it?
Welcome to the most health-conscious brothel in the history of mankind, I told him.
Thomas whistled quietly through his teeth, surveying the place. I heard that the Velvet Room had been retooled. This is it?
Yeah, I said. A brown-haired girl jiggled over to us, her mouth spread in a beauty contest smile, and for a second I thought her shirt was about to explode under the tension. Bright gold lettering over her left breast read, Billy.
Hello, Mr. Dresden, she chirped.
She bobbed her head to Thomas.
Sir, welcome to Executive Priority. Can I get you a drink before your workout? May I take your coats?
I held up a hand. Thanks, Billy, but no, I'm not here for the exercise. Her smile stayed locked in place, pretty and meaningless, and she tilted her head to one side. I'm here to speak to Ms. Demeter, I said.
I'm sorry, sir, Billy said. She isn't in.
The girl was a confection for the eyes, and I felt sure that the other four senses would feel just as well fed after a bit of indulgence, but she wasn't a good liar. Yeah, she is, I said. Tell her Harry Dresden is here.
I'm sorry, sir,
she said again, like a machine stuck on repeat.
Ms. Demeter is not in the building.
I gave her my toothiest smile. You're kind of new here, hey, Billy? The smile flickered, then stabilized again. Thomas, I sighed, give her a visual. My brother looked around, then went over to a nearby stack of steel dumbbells and picked up the largest set there, one in each hand. With about as much effort as I'd used to bundle twigs, he twisted the steel bars around one another, forming an asymmetric X shape. He held it up to make sure Billy saw it, then dropped it at her feet. The weights landed with a forceful thump, and Billy flinched when they did.
You should see the kind of things he can bend and break, I said. Expensive exercise machines, expensive furniture, expensive clients. I don't know how hard he could throw some of this stuff around, but I'd be lying if I told you I wasn't kind of curious. I leaned down a little closer and said, Billy, maybe you should kick this one up the line. I'd hate them to dock your pay to replace all the broken things.
I'll be right back, sir,
Billy said in a squeaky whisper and scurried away.
Subtle, Thomas noted.
I shrugged. It saves time. How did you get a membership to a place like this? It's Marcone's place. He thinks I'm less likely to trash it if I'm dazzled by friendly boobs.
Can't say that I blame him, Thomas admitted.
His eyes locked onto one particular girl who was currently at a table filling out paperwork. She froze in place and then looked up very slowly. Her lips parted as she stared at Thomas and her dark eyes widened. She started breathing faster and then shook herself and hurriedly looked down again, pretending to read her paperwork. My brother closed his eyes slowly and then turned his head away from the girl with the kind of steady, deliberate motion one uses to shut a heavy door. When he blinked his eyes open again, their color had shifted from deep gray to a pale gray-white, almost silver.
You okay? I asked him quietly.
Mm-hmm, he murmured. Sorry, got distracted. There's a kind of energy here.
Which I probably should have thought of, damn it. This building was home to constant regular acts of lust and desire. Those kind of activities left a sort of psychic imprint around them. A vibe Thomas must have picked up on.
Vampires, like my brother, take not blood, but life energy from their victims. Showing off his supernatural strength might have simplified things for us, but it also cost Thomas some of that energy. The same way an afternoon of hiking might leave you and me particularly hungry. Usually vampires of the White Court fed during the act of sex. They could induce desire in others, overwhelm their victims with undiluted primal lust. If he wanted to, Thomas could have paralyzed the girl where she stood, stalked over to her, and done whatever he pleased to her. There wouldn't have been anything she could do to stop him. Hell, she would have probably begged him to do more, and to hurry up about it. He wouldn't do it, not anymore, anyway. He'd fought that part of himself for years, and he'd finally found a way to keep it under control. By feeding in the equivalent of tiny, harmless nibbles from the customers in the upper-tier beauty salon he owned and operated, I gathered that while it did enable him to remain active and in control of himself, it was nowhere near as satisfying as acquiring energy the old-fashioned way, in a stalking seduction culminating in a burst of lust and ecstasy. I knew that his hunger, that inhuman portion of his soul that was driven by naked need, was screaming at him to do exactly that. If he did, though, it could do the girl serious harm, even kill her. My brother wasn't like that, but denying his hunger wasn't something that came naturally. It was a fight, and I knew what drove him to it. That girl looks a little like Justine, I commented. He froze at the name, his expression hardening. By gradual degrees, his eyes darkened to their usual color again. Thomas shook his head and gave me a wry smile. Does she?
Enough, I said. You okay?
As I ever am, he said. He didn't actually thank me, but it was in his voice. I pretended that I hadn't heard it there, which was what he expected me to do. It's a guy thing.
Billy came fibrillating back over to us. This way, please, sir, she said, her smile once again firmly in place. She led us rather nervously through the gym, passing the hallway that led to the showers and private therapy rooms in back. The door she led us through went to a very plain, practical, business-like hallway, one you'd find in any office building. She nodded to the last door in the hall, the corner office, and then retreated quietly. I ambled up to the door, knocked once, and then opened it.
to find Ms. Demeter sitting in her large but practical office behind her large but practical desk. She was a fit-looking woman, in early middle age, lean, well-dressed, and reserved. Her real name wasn't Demeter, but she preferred the professional sobriquet, and now wasn't the time to needle her. "Miss Demeter," I said, keeping my tone neutral. "Good day." She finished turning off her laptop, folded it shut, and put it away in a drawer before she looked up and gave me a quiet nod. "Mr. Dresden, what happened to your face?"
"It's always like this," I said. "I forgot to put on my makeup today."
"Ah," she said.
"Will you have a seat?"
"Thanks," I said. I sat down across the desk from her. "I apologize if I've inconvenienced you." Her shoulder twitched in a nano shrug.
"It's nice to know the limitations of those I've appointed my receptionist," she replied. "What can I do for you?"
Then she lifted her hand. "Wait. Allow me to rephrase. What can I do to most quickly get rid of you?" A sensitive guy might have felt a little hurt by that remark. Good thing I'm me. "I'm looking for Marcone," I told her.
"Have you called his office?"
I blinked slowly at her once, then I repeated. "I'm looking for Marcone."
"I'm sure you are," Demeter said, her expression never flickering. "What does that have to do with me?"
I felt a tight smile strain my lips. "Ms. D., I can't help but wonder why you instructed your receptionist to tell anyone who asked after you that you weren't in the office.
Perhaps I had some paperwork I needed to get done.
Or perhaps you know that Marcone is missing, and you're using it as a tactic to stall any of his lieutenants who come nosing around looking to fill the void." She stared at me for a moment, her expression giving away nothing.
"I can't really say that I know what you're talking about, Mr. Dresden."
"You sure you don't want to get rid of me?" I asked. "You want me to stay here and lean on you? I can make it really hard for you to do business if I'm feeling motivated."
"I'm sure," Demeter replied. "Why would you want to find him?"
I grimaced. "I have to help him." She arched a single well-plucked eyebrow.
"Have to?"
"It's complicated," I said.
"And not terribly credible," she replied. "I am well aware of your opinions regarding John Marcone. And even assuming that I had any information as to his whereabouts, I'm not sure that I'd wish to make a bad situation worse."
"How could you do that?" I asked.
"By involving you," she replied. "You clearly do not have Mr. Marcone's best interests in mind, and your involvement could push his captors into precipitous action. I doubt you'd lose a moment's sleep were he to be killed."
I would have shot back a witty reply if I hadn't slipped on a banana peel of self-recrimination, having said more or less those exact words not long before.
"But, sir,"
came Billy's voice in protest from the hall outside. The doorway darkened behind me, and I turned to find several large men standing there. The foremost of their number was a big guy, late 40s, with an ongoing romance with beer, or maybe pasta. He wore his heart on his pot belly. His well-tailored suit mostly hid the gut, and it would have concealed the shoulder rig and sidearm he wore beneath it if he'd made the least effort to avoid exposing it as he moved.
"Demeter," the big man said. "I need to speak to you privately."
"You couldn't afford me, Torelli," Demeter replied smoothly, "and I'm in the middle of a business meeting."
"Get one of your whores to get him off," Torelli said. "You and I have to talk."
She arched an eyebrow at him.
"Regarding?" "I need a list of your bank accounts, security passwords, and a copy of your records for the last 6 months," he scowled, looming over her. Torelli was the kind of guy who was used to getting his way if he loomed and scowled enough.
I knew the type. I tried to glance past the goons to see if Thomas was in the hallway, but could detect no sign of him.
"One wonders if you have been partaking of your product," Demeter said. "Why on earth should I provide you with my records, accounts, and funds?"
"Things are gonna change around here, whore, starting with your attitude."
Torelli glanced at two of the four men behind him and angled his head toward Demeter. The two goons, both of them medium-caliber Chicago bruisers, stepped around Torelli and walked toward her. I grimaced. I didn't care for Demeter much, personally, but I needed her, and I wouldn't be able to talk her into helping me if she were laid up in intensive care. Besides, she was a girl, and you don't hit girls. You don't let two-bit hired bullies do it, either. I stood up and turned to face Torelli's men, staff in hand. I gave them my hardest look, which didn't even slow them down. The one on the right threw something at my face, and I had no time to work out what it might be. I ducked, recognized it as a snow-speckled winter glove, and realized that it had been a distraction. The guy on the left came in on me when I was ducking and kicked a steel-toed work boot at my left knee. I turned my leg and took it on the shin. It hurt like hell, but at least I could still move. I rolled to one side, placing the goon on my left between myself and the goon on the right. He threw a looping right hand at me, and I met his knuckles with my staff. Knuckles crunched. The goon howled. The other one bowled past his pain-stunned partner and came at me, obviously planning on tackling me to the floor so that all of his buddies could circle up and kick me for a while. Couldn't have that. So I raised my right hand, clenched in a fist, bearing four triple-wire bands, one on each finger. With a thought and a word, I released the kinetic energy stored in one of the rings. It hit the goon like a locomotive, slamming him back and to the floor with a very satisfying thud. I turned and kicked the stunned first goon in both shins. Ha! Then placed one of my heels against his hip and shoved him to the floor. He crumpled. I turned to find myself staring down the barrel of Torelli's gun. Not bad, kid, the would-be kingpin said. That judo or something?
Something like that.
I could use a man of your skills. Once my health club finishes, he gave Demeter a sour glance. Reprioritizing. You couldn't afford me, I said.
I'm gonna be able to afford a lot, he said. Name your price.
$156 gajillion, I said promptly. He squinted at me as if trying to decide if I was joking, or maybe he was just trying to figure out how many zeros I was talking about.
Think you're cute, huh?
I'm freaking adorable, I said, especially with the raccoon face I've got going here. Torelli's features darkened.
Kid, you just made the last mistake of your life.
God, I said, I wish. Thomas put the barrel of his Desert Eagle against the back of Torelli's head and said in a pleasant voice, lose the iron, nice and slow. Torelli stiffened in surprise and wasted no time in complying. He turned his head slightly, looking for his two other goons. I could see a pair of feet lying toes up in the hallway, but there was no other sign of them. I stepped up to him and said, calmly, take your men and get out. Don't come back. He regarded me with dull eyes, then pressed his lips together, nodded once, and began gathering up his men. Thomas picked up Torelli's gun and stuck it down the front of his pants, just like you're not supposed to do. He walked quietly over to stand beside me, his eyes tracking every movement the thugs made. They departed, half carrying the poor bastard with the broken hand, while the two in the hallway staggered along, barely recovered from being choked unconscious. Once they were gone, I turned to face Demeter. Where were we?
I was questioning your motives, she said.
I shook my head. Helen, you know who I am. You know what I do. Yeah, I think Marcone is a twisted son of a bitch who probably deserves to die. But that doesn't mean I'm planning on carrying out the deed. She stared at me in silence for 10 or 15 seconds. Then she turned to her desk, drew out a notepad, and wrote something on a piece of paper. She folded it and offered it to me. I reached out for it, but when I tugged, she didn't let go.
Promise me, she said. Give me your word that you'll do everything you can to help him. I sighed. Of course.
The words tasted like a rancid pickle coated in salt and vinegar, but I managed to say them.
I will. You have my word.
Demeter let go of the paper. I looked at it, an address, nothing more.
It might help you, she said. It might not.
That's more than I had a minute ago, I said. I nodded to Thomas. Let's go. Dresden, Demeter said as I walked to the door. I paused. Thank you for handling Torelli. He would have hurt some of my girls tonight. I glanced back at her and nodded once. Then Thomas and I headed for the suburbs. Chapter 12. Marcone's business interests were wide and varied. They had to be when you're laundering as much money as he was. He had restaurants, holding companies, import-export businesses,
investment firms, financial businesses of every description, and construction companies. Sunset Point was one of those boils festering on the face of the planet, a subdivision. Located half an hour north of Chicago, it had once been a pleasant little wood of rolling hills around a single tiny river. The trees and hills had all been bulldozed flat, exposing naked earth to the sky. The little river had been choked into a sludgy trough. Underneath the blanket of snow, the place looked as smooth and white and sterile as the inside of a new refrigerator. "Look at this," I said to Thomas. I gestured at the houses, each of them on a lot that exceeded the building's foundation by the width of a postage stamp. "People pay to live in places like this?" "You live in the basement of a boarding house," Thomas said. "I live in a big city, and I rent," I said. "Houses like these go for several hundred thousand dollars, if not more. It'll take 30 years to pay them off." "They're nice houses," Thomas said. "They're nice cages," I responded. "No space around them. Nothing alive. Places like this turn a man into a gerbil. He comes home and scurries inside. Then he stays there until he's forced to go back out to the job he has to work so that he can make the mortgage payments on this gerbil habitat."
"And they're way nicer than your apartment," Thomas said.
"Totally." He brought the Hummer to a crunching halt in the snow, glaring through the windshield.
"Damn snow. I'm only guessing where the streets are at this point."
"Just don't drive into what's going to be somebody's basement," I said. "We passed 23rd a minute ago. We must be close."
"23rd Court, Place, Street, Terrace, or Avenue?" Thomas asked.
"Circle."
"Damned cul-de-sacs."
He started forward again, driving slowly. "There," he said, nodding to the next sign that emerged from the haze.
"That one?"
"Yeah." Next to the customized street sign was a standard road sign declaring 24th Terrace a dead end.
"Damn foreshadowing," I muttered.
"What's that?"
"Nothing."
We drove through the murky gray and white of a heavy snowfall, the light luminous, without source, reflected from billions of crystals of ice. The Hummer's engine was a barely audible purr. By comparison, the crunch of its tires on snow was a dreadful racket. We rolled past half a dozen model houses, all of them lovely and empty, the snow piling up around windows that gaped like eye sockets in a half-buried skull. Something wasn't right. I couldn't have told you what, exactly, but I could feel it as plainly as I could feel the carved wood of the staff I gripped in my hands. We weren't alone. Thomas felt it, too. Moving smoothly, he reached an arm behind the driver's seat and drew forth his sword belt. It bore an old U.S. cavalry saber he'd carried on a number of dicey occasions, paired with a more recent toy he'd become fond of, a bent-bladed knife called a kukri, like the one carried by the Gurkhas.
"What is that?" he asked quietly.
I closed my eyes for a moment, reaching out with my arcane senses, attempting to detect any energies that might be moving in around us. The falling snow muffled my magical perceptions every bit as much as it did my physical senses.
"Not sure," I said quietly. "But whatever it is, it's a safe bet it knows we're here. How do you want to play it if the music starts?"
"I've got nothing to prove," I said. "I say we run like little girls."
"Suits me, but don't let Murphy hear you talking like that."
"Yeah, she gets oversensitive about little." My shoulders tightened with the tension as Thomas drove forward slowly and carefully. He stopped the car beside the last house on the street. It had a finished look to it, the bushes of its landscaping poking up forlornly through the snow. There were curtains in the windows, and the faint marks of tire tracks, not quite full of new snowfall, leading up the drive and to the closed garage.
"Someone's behind that third window," Thomas said quietly. "I saw them move."
I hadn't seen anything, but then I wasn't a supernatural predator, complete with a bucket full of preternaturally sharp senses. I nodded to let him know that I'd heard him, and scanned the ground around the house. The snow was untouched.
"We're the first visitors," I said. "We're probably making someone nervous."
"Gunman?"
"Probably," I said. "That's what most of Marcone's people are used to. Come on."
"You don't want me to wait out here?"
I shook my head. "There's something else out here. It might be nothing, but you're a sitting duck in the car. Maybe if you'd gotten the armored version..."
"Nag, nag, nag," Thomas said.
"Let's be calm and friendly," I said.
I opened the door of the Hummer and stepped out into the snow that came up over my knees.
I made sure not to move too quickly and kept my hands out in plain sight. On the other side of the Hummer, Thomas mirrored me.
"Hello, the house!"
I called.
"Anyone home?"
My voice had that flat, heavy timbre you can only get when there's a lot of snow, almost like we were standing inside.